listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Hey, today I want to talk about the Electoral College and what some Democratic presidential candidates have to say about it, as well as some articles in the news. For instance, a journalist in the United Kingdom is having to undergo police questioning because she misgendered somebody. Outrageous. Also want to talk about Beto O'Rourke's comments about abortion this week and much more. Before we get to all that, first, a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren kicked off the discussion about the Electoral College during a CNN town hall. She was asked about voting rights. Here's what she said.
And that is, I believe we need a constitutional amendment that protects the right to vote for every American citizen and to make sure that vote gets counted.
I have to stop for a second and just point out, we already have a constitutional amendment that protects the right of people to vote, and that's the 14th Amendment. So apparently, she needs to brush up on the Constitution a little bit.
We need to put some federal muscle behind that, and we need to repeal every one of the voter suppression laws that is out there right now.
That would be voter ID.
And I'll tell you one more. We need to make sure that every vote counts. And I want to push that right here in Mississippi, because I think this is an important point. You know, come a general election, presidential candidates don't come to places like Mississippi. Yeah. They also don't come to places like California and Massachusetts, right? Because we're not the battleground states. Well, my view is that every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen... is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and everybody.
Get rid of the Electoral College. That's a horrible idea. So, you know, one thing that she mentioned is how presidential candidates often don't go to different states during the general election. But here's the thing, they don't because they have a limited amount of time and resources. And frankly, that's not going to change even if you go to a national, you know, popular vote and you eliminate the Electoral College. It's going to be the same. It's just going to change where they end up going. President Trump actually made mention of this, if I could actually bring up the points he made on Twitter. He doesn't always make good points on Twitter, but for this he said, campaigning for the popular vote is much easier and different than campaigning for the Electoral College. This is a tweet that he posted yesterday. That would be today's Wednesday. That'd be Tuesday. He goes on. He says, it's like training for the 100-yard dash versus a marathon. The brilliance of the Electoral College is that you must go to many states to win with the popular vote. You go just the large states, the cities would end up running the country. Smaller states in the entire Midwest would end up losing all the power. And we can't let that happen. I used to like the idea of the popular vote, but now realize the Electoral College is far better for the USA. Of course, you know, he was a beneficiary of the Electoral College, so there's that. But all, you know, we had different candidates jump on the get rid of the Electoral College bandwagon. Here's Beto O'Rourke asked about it this week.
I think there's a lot to that, because you had an election in 2016 where the loser got 3 million more votes than the victor. It puts some states out of play altogether. They don't feel like their votes really count. So if we really want every person to vote and give them every reason to vote, we got to make sure their votes count and go to the candidate of their choosing. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, and it's something that we talked about on the campaign trail in Texas in that last Senate race.
You have pressure.
Okay, I just want to point out, everybody, your vote does, you know, when you vote for president, your vote counts. We do have a popular election. We have 50 popular elections plus DC, so I guess 51 popular elections in the United States. Your vote counts. Your vote for president does not, when you vote for president of your state, even if your candidate loses your state, it still counts because it went toward who determining who that state's electors were going to be. So, you know, this is this idea that your vote somehow doesn't count because we have an electoral college rather than a national popular vote is ludicrous. And again, he's talking about some states feel like they don't matter. That's not going to change with a national popular vote. It's just going to realign what states don't matter. And in Democrats' minds, basically, it means that the states that I like are going to matter, and the states that I don't care so much for aren't. So basically, you'd have a focus on California, you'd have a focus on Florida, you'd have a focus on New York, you'd have a focus on Texas, so mainly L.A., Houston, Miami, New York City, Chicago. So larger cities tend to be more Democratic. And, you know, the idea is the national popular vote will go, you know, towards them, basically towards those candidates. Now, here's the thing. You know, Republicans have won the national popular vote before. But, you know, the reason why we have this, this electoral college is for every state to weigh in. That way, no one state can, you know, dominate the conversation because, okay, they keep on bringing up, you know, Hillary Clinton lost. Or excuse me, she lost the election, but she won by 3 million votes. Well, here's the thing: most of her margin of victory was really most of that was in California. California had an outsized margin of victory. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Take California out of the mix, the national popular vote looks completely different. So, Kamala Harris also weighed in. She was on Jimmy Kimmel Live this week.
I think that I'm open to the discussion. I mean, there's no question that the popular vote has been diminished in terms of making the final decision about who's the president of the United States, and we need to deal with that. So I'm open to the discussion.
I'm open to the discussion. Well, that's, you know, I don't want to dismiss it outright, but I don't want to say exactly that I'm in favor of this because, you know, that might come across bad. Again, the popular vote, your vote matters. In each state, your vote matters. So Bernie Sanders, he hasn't weighed in the latest, you know, round of bashing the Electoral College, but he did talk about it on election night 2016. You listen, this was on an interview. He was on being interviewed on CNN discussing the results as they came in.
You mentioned that Hillary Clinton is now nearing a 2 million vote lead in the popular vote, but she obviously right. has shown a solid loss in the Electoral College. Do you think the Electoral College system should be reexamined?
I do. I'll tell you why. I mean, on the surface, you just said it. We have one candidate who got 2 million more votes than the other candidate, but she is not going to be sworn in as president. And I think on the surface, that's a little bit weird. The second thing that bothers me is that, as everybody knows that during the campaign, we have states, California, New York, and many others that are traditionally Democratic. You have a whole lot of states that are traditionally Republican. The needs and the people of those states are ignored during the political process. And then what ends up happening is campaigns basically are about 16, 17 states battleground states in this country. And I think that's unfair to the other 30 plus states that also would like to be participating in the political process.
Again, I don't know how you get around that, because here's Andrew Yang. He's also a Democrat. He's an entrepreneur who is a Democratic candidate. He actually kind of went against the trend here. He said, he tweeted out on the 17th, "The problem with deciding presidential elections via popular vote is that candidates would naturally campaign in urban areas with big media markets, and their policies would follow suit. Better to have proportional electoral college votes in each state so you can campaign everywhere." And each state, frankly, they can decide that for themselves. Nebraska has that. Maine has that. I believe those are the only two states that have some sort of proportional electoral college votes. You know, other states can decide to do that. But here's, you know, with this discussion about eliminating the electoral college, one thing that, you know, I'm asking too, are you talking about, first of all, amending the Constitution? That would be the proper way. If you want to repeal the Electoral College, that is the constitutional method of getting rid of it, if that's what you want to do. That's a hard process. So, of course, that's not the process they're probably going to follow. Instead, you got this this National Popular Vote Initiative, where states are signing on to say, you know, our electors will vote for the candidate that wins the Electoral College, wins the national popular vote, which, you know, it's an end around the Constitution for one thing. Can states legally do that? Probably. So far it hasn't been enacted, so we don't have any legal precedent. We don't know how that would fare in the courts. But it is an end around the Constitution, and what that would end up doing is disenfranchising voters in a particular state, especially if that state went for another candidate that didn't win the national popular vote. Then you have the opposite problem. And also too, and this is the thing, you know, Elizabeth Warren, back to her comments, she wants to, you know, she wants to implement all this federal stuff and nationalize the vote. Elections have historically been up to the states. Here's another reason why national popular vote would be unfair, because, well, first of all, each state has different early voting laws. They have different laws surrounding absentee ballots. Some allow felons, you know, ex-cons to vote. Some don't. Here in Iowa, we're having that discussion, and we'll likely, you know, we're in process of amending our constitution to allow felons who, you know, have been released from prison to vote. And I think that's the right thing to do. I think if you served your time, I think you need to be off parole first. But, you know, I haven't looked at the exact language, whether it's released from prison or off parole. However, that's decided. As long as you've paid your time, you paid your debt to society, you should have your rights restored. You know, obviously, you got some issues possibly with, I can go down a rabbit trail with gun rights and ex-cons, and you know, I think if you're a violent felon, I don't disagree with withholding your right to own a weapon, just because, well, you know, if you've used it for a crime, I think you can lose that right permanently. You might disagree or not disagree. It doesn't matter, but that's a rabbit trail. That's not exactly what I want to talk about today. But anyway, states have, you know, those different laws. They have different laws regarding voting hours. I mean, so states are different. Now, I suppose, you know, you can nationalize everything, but that doesn't, but that's not the right tack, because, you know, frankly, every state has, along with, it's not just federal elections, you've got their own state elections, and the feds shouldn't be telling the states how to run their state elections. So there's a lot of problems with the national popular vote, and I think, you know, good kudos to Andrew Yang for pointing out the problem, at least from what it would end up leading to. I'm I'm willing to have a discussion about proportional electoral college votes. I don't necessarily think it's needed for every state, but I can see that's certainly a better solution than just eliminating the electoral college altogether. It would still force candidates to be, you know, the presidential candidates would still have to be gain support in a majority of congressional districts or whatnot. So that's the thing too with you know, national popular vote versus electoral college. A candidate can just, if they're just popular in cities, but they're not popular throughout, if they don't have support throughout the entire nation, they're still not representative of the nation. And that's the thing. You look at the electoral college map, President Trump, he had better representation throughout the entire nation than Hillary Clinton did. Same is true with George W. Bush and Al Gore back in 2000 when President Bush lost the popular vote but won the Electoral College. Of course, then, you know, Democrats kind of overlooked this. In 2004, he won the popular vote and the Electoral College. Anyway, it seems like one of the things I'm getting tired of is how whenever things don't go their way, Democrats want to eliminate, you know, just change the rules. And that's, you know, the Constitution set this up for a reason. It's set up so we can have states, each state can have a voice. And I think jettisoning it, unlike what Beto O'Rourke said, is not wise. I think it's very foolish. Speaking of Beto O'Rourke, he's made a rather remarkable comment about late-term abortions and children who survive abortion attempts. Oh, before playing clips of Beto O'Rourke's discussion on abortion, I want to make sure to mention that not only did the 14th Amendment provide the right to vote, but also the Constitution was then amended later on to allow women the right to vote, as well as then change the voting age to 18. So the Constitution has been amended. I don't know what constitutional amendment Elizabeth Warren would promote that would extend voting rights beyond what people already have, other than probably it would be something that would Bigfoot all over the 10th Amendment, and that's, you know, that would be unfortunate. At least, you know, I have to give her kudos. At least she's talking about amending the Constitution rather than trying to do it by federal statute. So whether she's that's how she would approach the Electoral College, that I don't know. Beto O'Rourke was in New Hampshire, and he was asked by a college student his view of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Act that did not pass in the U.S. Senate, that was sponsored by U.S. Senator Ben Sasse, and this is what he had to say.
For being here, you gave me a good excuse to get out of school.
Happy to oblige.
I wanted to ask you about a recent bill that just went through the Senate about 2 weeks ago, and the bill was that if an abortion was performed on a viable fetus and the fetus survived the abortion, the doctor would then be compelled to give that living baby the same care as any other pregnancy baby that came out and put that baby through the care. Would you support this bill that does not in any way limit abortion and simply seeks to keep babies alive that have been born alive?
Thank you for the question. The way that I would approach your question and this issue generally is to trust women to make their own decisions about their own bodies. When we talk about universal guarantee, high quality health care for everyone in this country, it's primary health care, it's mental health care, and it's women's health care. And I'll tell you why. In my home state of Texas, we have shut down our state legislature, our governors, more than half the family planning clinics in our state, making it that much harder for women to get a cervical cancer screening, see a family planning provider, or see a provider of any kind. We also, not coincidentally, are at the epicenter of a maternal mortality crisis. that disproportionately affects women of color 2 to 3 times the rate of white women in that state and across this country. So women's health care, reproductive rights, Roe versus Wade, all the way back to 1973, the law of the land. This next election will decide all of those issues because it will also decide the composition of the Supreme Court.
So he then doubles down. The next day he was asked to clarify and to confirm during a kind of an interview after a Q&A session he had at State College, Pennsylvania, which is where Penn State University is located. I apologize about the audio quality here. I think this is just from an iPhone camera or a cell phone camera, and they're outside and there's buses running. But here it is.
So I just want to make sure that I had clarity. Yesterday on abortion, you said it's a woman's right to choose. Correct?
Absolutely.
Does that include it up until the third trimester?
Listen, I think those decisions are best left to a woman and her doctor. I know better than to assume anything about a woman's decision, an incredibly difficult decision when it comes to her reproductive rights. So Roe versus Wade, though it is being tested unlike any other time, is still the law of the land, must be upheld, and we must ensure that when we're talking about universal health care, we're also talking about women's health care, and when we're talking about women's health care, we're talking about women making their own decisions about their own bodies.
So basically here we're looking at him endorsing the idea of universal health care along with abortion and Roe v. Wade. And I guess the question is, does he believe, and I think he does, because I think this is pretty much where the Democratic Party's headed. I don't just think this is what they've said in their party platform, headed towards taxpayer funding for abortions that would be part of this universal health care plan, which is pretty outrageous. There's a related article. There was an article written by a abortion activist in Politico magazine, Jack Schaefer. He basically, the title of the article that was published on today, Wednesday, says, "I am an abortion rights activist. I hope the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade." Pretty intriguing headline there. Goes on, he says, quote, "So why am I so happy the United States' strongest abortion protection is hanging in the balance? Because if Roe v. Wade's fate really comes before the Supreme Court, then for the first time in decades, the abortion rights movement will understand that the threat it is facing is not theoretical, and its supporters will stop fighting like it is. Despite a pitched and unyielding culture war over the issue, the legality of abortion alone has allowed much of the United States to look at abortion as a second-tier political issue, one those on the left say they support but never have a problem compromising on. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, the decision will finally force the ideological zeal typical of a political opposition, the force that has long powered the anti-abortion movement, onto the abortion rights movement. And liberal complacency on the issue of abortion could end for good. High-ranking agenda-setting Democrats have long signaled to others in the party that abortion is safe enough to be used as a bargaining chip to accomplish other goals. In 2017, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Ben Ray Lujan, said that there should be no litmus test on abortion, that being opposed to abortion rights didn't necessarily disqualify a candidate from party backing and financial support. When it comes to the question of bringing in more moderate voters, as Lujan and other Big Ten Democrats like him illustrate, support for the unceasingly controversial issue of abortion is the first thing to go. Democrats similarly bartered abortion access away during the Obamacare debate in 2009. That year, 64 Democrats in the House, including 17 who would be considered pro-choice and 7 in the Senate, voted for the Stupak-Pitts and Nelson amendments to the Affordable Care Act, respectively. Those amendments banned abortion coverage in any plans in the federal insurance exchanges and debate that resulted from them was instrumental in garnering the last few votes needed to pass the health bill. Now, here's the thing. He's complaining about those two amendments to the Obamacare, to the Affordable Care Act. That's not protecting abortion rights. That's forcing taxpayers to pay for abortion for people that, you know, want to have them under those plans. That is not the same thing, but that's where the Democratic Party is headed. And I find that amazing that he thinks that Democrats are complacent about this issue. I've said the same thing, and a lot of pro-life activists have said the same thing as with the Republican Party, that it's a second-tier issue. That a lot of Republicans want to move off of social issues. We had a GOP deliver an autopsy of the 2012 election, kind of suggesting that we move away from social issues, not necessarily change what we believe, but not necessarily campaign on it. By and large, this issue is downplayed by Republican candidates in the general election, especially. But when you look at Planned Parenthood and activists backing them, that certainly doesn't look like a second tier issue for them, and doesn't seem like a second tier issue for most Democratic Party when they can't pass things like the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Act, which does not restrict abortion rights whatsoever. What would happen if Roe v. Wade got struck down is simply this. It would return the decision back to the states. Some states would probably further restrict abortion. Other states, like, well, New York, for instance, and Vermont, and some other states are trying to expand abortion rights up to the moment of birth. And we would take this conversation, this debate, the state level. But that's not what Democrats want, because they know in certain states, like, for instance, Mississippi, they're on the verge of passing a very strict abortion ban. Several states have passed fetal heartbeat abortion bans. So, taking this to the state level does not help those who are pro-choice. But That's what would happen with Roe v. Wade if it got overturned. Abortion suddenly wouldn't disappear from the United States. It would just move the political conversation from the federal level elsewhere. Speaking of political conversations and Supreme Court, the Senate GOP is poised to go nuclear on Trump picks. This is from The Hill. Jordan Carney from The Hill, he writes, quote, Senate Republicans are set to hit the gas on confirming hundreds of President Trump's nominees by muscling through a rules change that would dramatically cut down the amount of time required to confirm district court and executive nominations. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who supports the change, hasn't tipped his hand on when the proposal will come to the Senate floor, but members of his leadership team say it will be taken up after lawmakers return to Washington next week. I think we'll have 51 Republicans who would rather do it with 60 votes, most of us, said Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri, a member of the leadership who helped spearhead the proposal, along with Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma. We cannot continue to let this current situation be the way we do business. Republicans say they want to change the rules by way of a standing order, which would require 60 votes and the support of Democrats, but recognize that they are unlikely to hit that mark, since no Democrats are signaling support. The resolution would reduce the amount of debate time required for district judge picks and most executive nominations. The Senate allows for an additional 30 hours of debate on nominees, even after it's clear that they can defeat a filibuster and ultimately be confirmed. The Blunt-Lankford proposal would reduce that extra time to as few as 2 hours. Supreme Court nominees, appeals court judges, cabinet picks, and roughly a dozen boards and commissions would be exempt from the proposed change. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea. It will be interesting to see if that actually gets implemented. Also, talking about the court, this is Bill Mears wrote this in FoxNews.com yesterday. 2020 Democrats eye dramatic increase in Supreme Court justices. All options are on the table. Quote, it's become the hot new topic on the 2020 presidential campaign trail. Several Democratic contenders are talking up plans to overhaul the Supreme Court, with some offering proposals to add up to 10 more members. Candidates including Senators Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Kirsten Gillibrand have all signaled an openness to overhauling the court if they become president. And progressive groups are putting their money behind the message in an effort to tap into lingering liberal anger over President Trump's two nominees confirmed to the high court. They said first they steal a Supreme Court seat and then they turn around and change the rules on the filibuster on a Supreme Court seat, Warren said in a recent radio interview. So when it swings back to us, what are we going to do? I think all options are on the table. So, you know, again, Democrats, when they lose, they want to change the rules, which is completely outrageous. This is what Franklin D. Roosevelt did when the Supreme Court started striking down his New Deal proposals. He stacked the court. He added to it so he would get the rulings he wanted. This is bad. This is a horrible idea. And frankly, I'm tired. I am so tired of the progressive just complaint fest over the court. As a conservative, as somebody who believes in the strict interpretation of the law, as somebody who believes in originalism and textualism, I have been frustrated with the Supreme Court for years. The Supreme Court has had an activist bent since I've been alive. And only until fairly recently have we had a little bit of balance with some close 5-4 decisions. Now, you know, yes, there's been some good decisions of late, but it's still kind of a crapshoot with how, like, for instance, Chief Justice John Roberts, what way he's going to go, because he seems to be torn between, his originalism view of the Constitution and his view of honoring precedent. Frankly, I think the two things are at odds. They don't have to always be at odds, but he needs to. I wish he would be consistent on when the two things are at odds. He would go with originalism over precedent, because sometimes precedent is bad. Anyway, here's the thing. If Democrats stack the court, well, hey, when Republicans office, they'll stack the court, and then you'll on and on and on, and pretty soon, you know, how many judges are we going to end up having? 100? I mean, how were we going to cap it? I think Congress was wise in capping the number of Supreme Court justices after FDR ended up stacking the court. 9 justices, that's enough. We don't need any more. We won't have a tie unless, for some reason, there's a vacancy that hadn't been filled yet. This is the right number, and frankly, they just need to leave it alone. Elections have consequences. They lost. The Senate is still in Republican hands. And frankly, complaining, Elizabeth Warren complaining about the filibuster rule on a lot of judges, you know, that Democrats have nobody to blame but themselves for that. They're the ones that went down that road. And we warned at the time that, you know, they're going to come to regret it, and they're regretting it now. They shouldn't have done it. They used the nuclear option first. One last article to wrap up. This is from the Christian Post. Christian journalist to be interrogated by police for misgendering activist transgender child. Brandon Showalter wrote this at the Christian Post. A Catholic journalist in England is being told by police that she might have committed a criminal offense because she, quote unquote, misgendered someone and will be soon interrogated under caution. The authorities contacted Caroline Farrow, who writes for the UK-based Catholic Herald, after a September appearance on Good Morning Britain. During the interview, Farrow argued the position that single-sex spaces in children's schools and in other places of public accommodation should be maintained, and noted, among other things, that females do not have penises. What prompted the police action, however, is that Farrow allegedly referred to Green's child who is now called Jackie, a biological male who underwent a surgical procedure in Thailand several years ago to remove his genitals, with incorrect pronouns on Twitter. And going on, Pharaoh says, I have to go and be interviewed under caution, a taped interview where I'll be shown offending tweets which supposedly constitute the offense of malicious communications. If you look up the offense, you'll see that I am not in breach. I haven't threatened or said anything that I know to be untrue or is indecent or grossly offensive. So, you know, it's crazy. Going on, she says, I've pointed out to the police that I'm a Catholic journalist and commentator. It's my religious belief that a person cannot change sex, that we're in the middle of a national conversation about what it means to be male, what it means to be female. She explained on Twitter Monday about what she told police. She says if she does not go into the interview, she was informed that she'll be arrested. And this is just insane. This is insane. This is... Great Britain was one of the first nations to, you know, one of the first Western democracies. Certainly, yes, it's a constitutional monarchy, but they had the understanding of rights. They have an understanding of free speech. They have an understanding of free press. But all this is being thrown under the bus because of the stupid, woke, social justice, politically correct crap. And the fact that, by the way, this kind of hate crime, Great Britain Today tweeted out this morning that this kind of thing is actually could be, so a person could be jailed up to 2 years. That's appalling. They asked the question whether or not police should be investing resources into this, you know, kind of thing when knife attacks are on the rise. And my response is UK subjects should be frustrated and they should demand that kind of law be repealed. It is crazy that you have a police state who are monitoring your social media. And yes, this is in the United Kingdom right now, but with the push for greater and greater LGBTQ accommodation rights, you got the Equality Act that was introduced last week in Congress, reintroduced last week in Congress, that would eliminate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or basically make it, you know, make it largely ineffective, if not repeal it. They got a Do No Harm Act that would actually repeal it. You know, it's not hard to understand that this could potentially come to the United States as well. This kind of a mindset, and I don't think we want that. But anyway, hey, thank you so much for taking time to listen today. And that concludes today's podcast. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on your on the website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com. You could just Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our email updates. Our podcast is on several apps. You can go to Apple Podcasts. You can go to Google Play. We're on Stitcher. We're on Spotify. We're on SoundCloud. We're on Podbean. If there's an app we're missing, you know, be sure to let me know. Shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com. And I'll work to get that added to another app as well. But thank you so much for listening. Hey, until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.